happened.
You're listening to The Andy Fin Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS Radio Network.
We are back on The Andy Fin Show, and we're still talking about Bob Woodward's new book. The excerpts in the Monday paper were, today's paper, October 2nd, were about the debate within the administration at the changing of the guard after the 2004 elections. Should Rummy stay or should he go? So before we get to that, though, Rumsfeld, again, being a Vietnam-era kind of a guy, it's worth referring back to this comparison between Iraq and Vietnam. And I'm not trying to be overdramatic here and say, oh, it's another Vietnam. I think Iraq has very different and very special problems, but there is a way in which the psychology is the same. That there's one camp in this country that believes all you have to do is apply more force and you win something. If you think about it in terms of whether it's plumbing or working on your car, actually, no. If you apply more force, a lot of times you break something. And once you break something off, like one of the screws, one of the bolts on your the engine head, things like that are very expensive and messy to replace. So, Mike, another veteran of the same era as Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Kissinger is Robert McNamara. And Robert McNamara is one of the Democrats that came through the Vietnam War and was chastened by it and learned from it. And he came out with 10 basic lessons that he learned about how to deal with global politics and the military and war or the possibility of war when you're dealing with other countries. Why don't you read off for me a couple of the more salient ones?
Okay, I'll start you off with this one. If we cannot persuade other nations with similar interests and values of the merits of our proposed use of that power, we should not proceed unilaterally, except in the unlikely requirement to defend directly the continental U.S., Alaska, and Hawaii.
Well, and of course, that's the argument that Bush eventually was forced to make. The country was not going to let him go into Iraq just because Iraq was acting up and just because, and there were a few reasons, but they'd violated U.N. resolutions, the horror of it. He had used WMD on his own people, but he seemed pretty well contained to most of us once the U.N. stripped him of much of what he had after the Gulf War demolished his army and I guess a little bit of a navy. So he was kind of in a box, but Bush had to go to the country and say not simply he has weapons, not simply he's in violation, not simply he tried to kill my father, not simply he's thumbing his nose at America. He had to say the homeland's in danger. We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. I can't promise you, but we shouldn't take a chance. So Bush got permission from the people to go after Saddam. And what's interesting is he couldn't persuade our allies. Even the countries right nearest to Iraq were not interested in signing up and going in. Now, that's very different from 91. When his father went in to remove Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, he had a masterful coalition he put together of, I don't know, 80-some nations. This was not the coalition of the willing where he had to bribe people to come along. There may have been a little bit of that, but he had the weight of world opinion behind him when he went in. Bush didn't. He tried to get it. He tried to get it. He couldn't get it. And in the end, he said, we have to go alone because you don't want the country of France in charge of American security decisions. That was essentially the argument he used, kind of a jingoistic argument that other countries are trying to keep us from protecting ourselves. It really is pretty unconscionable. And the lesson from Vietnam was right there for Bush to learn from. But he probably would never have read Robert McNamara's book. How about another one?
I like this one because it certainly deals with one of the root causes, I believe, of terrorism, and one you've mentioned before, and that's poverty, being disenfranchised, not having the opportunities that other countries or other peoples have.
So lay it on me.
Oh, I lost it. There we go. We, the richest nation in the world, have failed in our responsibility to our own poor and to the disadvantaged across the world to help them advance their welfare in the most fundamental terms of nutrition, literacy, health, and employment.
I think that's true. And for example, if you look at who's helping rebuild Lebanon after Israel caused billions of dollars of damage in their attempt to, you know, cripple Hezbollah, it's Hezbollah who's putting millions of dollars in there to rebuild these people's lives. That's just the U.S. should have been right there with billions in aid. If Israel destroys it, we should rebuild it. There should be U.S. labels on everything they're using over there.
Hezbollah is certainly winning the hearts and minds.
That's how you win people over. But I do want to correct one notion, and that is, I don't mean to imply, as we were saying, as when you said this, Mike, that it's because there are poor and disadvantaged that we have terrorism. This is not primarily poor people reaching out. A lot of these folks that get radical, that pick up bombs and try and kill Westerners in general, but people, innocent people, as we like to say, a lot of those people are educated. They're actually middle class. They could have a bright future. They've turned to this. Part of that is poverty, but a bigger part of it is a sense of helplessness and the feeling that Islamic countries, Muslim countries, get beat up in the global competition for success, whatever that means, right? Having industry that produces stuff. Now, they also have the problem that they're culturally not advancing as quickly, meaning women don't have the same freedom. So if you tie half your population's hands behind their back, you're limiting their contribution. We did that for centuries in the West, but we're just a little bit ahead of that. But so there's all kinds of differences to think about. But the bottom line is that if you can't put yourself in the place of someone else, then you really won't understand what motivates them and how to communicate with them, how to negotiate with them, and how to have diplomacy. And it's diplomacy that prevents war. And to that end, is the very first one about that very topic that I was just talking about?
No, actually it wasn't.
Okay. There was one that was, I thought.
This one is actually more in that direction. If we are to deal effectively with terrorists across the globe, we must develop a sense of empathy. I don't mean sympathy, but rather understanding to counter their attacks on us and the Western world.
Yeah, now he could be talking strategically there, but it isn't simply that you have to know what they think so you can anticipate their moves. It is true that if they claim they have grievances, to say you won't listen to their grievances, I'm not saying sit down and negotiate with them when they're holding people hostage. I mean, we'd be foolish not to be well informed. And it turns out one of their grievances was, Osama bin Laden's primary grievance in the 90s was the fact that the U.S. went in to throw Saddam out of Kuwait. And then we left a huge military presence in Saudi Arabia. Now, we got oil fields to protect, admittedly, but we underestimated how much of an offense that is to Muslims, because two of their three holiest shrines are in Mecca and Medina, right there in Saudi Arabia. And it was considered a sacrilege. Now, I'm not saying Osama wouldn't have found another reason to be mad at the West, but I'm saying that he was able to use that to radicalize other Muslims, young Muslims, maybe impressionable Muslims, maybe well-educated, but still put religion first. And so I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that if you're going to take responsibility for your actions, you have to understand that sometimes your actions have unintended consequences. So that's why going into Iraq was considered foolish by a lot of people that understand international politics. If the complaint that Osama's rallying people with is that the West, the infidels, have a military presence in our holiest of lands, then going into Iraq with 150,000 troops next door is not going to help. It's going to hurt. Besides the fact that there were plenty of predictions that it was a quagmire and that there wasn't a good way out. So another example of where there were lessons from Vietnam that we could have learned that, Bush doesn't have the maturity and the sense of history and the knowledge of history to know what the lesson of it is. And I suspect listening to Cheney and listening to Rumsfeld and Kissinger, Bush fervently believes that Vietnam would have been won if only we'd sent more troops. Of course, not him and not me, but more troops. We got another one?
Yes, we do. One of the greatest dangers we face today is the risk that terrorists will obtain access to weapons of mass destruction as a result of the breakdown of the non-proliferation regime. We in the U.S. are contributing to that breakdown.
Well, there's a number of angles on this. This book was written in 95 by McNamara. This doesn't really sound like Lessons of Vietnam. I had one that was 10 Lessons of Vietnam at one point that was really right all about Vietnam. These are more general, and these are good lessons. But I think that what... There's no question. I've been arguing since 1991 with the breakup of the Soviet Union that we should be putting billions in the direction of securing their nukes and securing their nuclear scientists. You know, Mike, you've heard me say this. We should be giving each of them a job at least $100,000 a year. I don't care if they try and invent a new kind of Play-Doh, but occupy them and give them an income so nobody hires them away to build nuclear weapons for some renegade country. We have not done a good job securing the Russian nukes and the scientists behind them. And the other kinds of things out there, I mean, they're fairly small potatoes. Pakistan's selling all this equipment to Iran and Libya and North Korea is obviously not good. But the biggest threat in terms of these a few nukes getting loose in the hands of terrorists is clearly the Russian arsenal. So that's a problem. One more, and then we better go on.
Okay, hold on here. Lost the page there.
Well, that's okay, because basically Robert McNamara, I can just sum it up and say Robert McNamara learned a number of things from Vietnam. The Democrats learned from Vietnam. Now, the country kind of looks at that and says, oh, the Democrats have cold feet on defense, or the Democrats aren't willing to stand up. No, the Democrats just aren't willing to shoot first and ask questions later. And so that's the lesson of Vietnam, is don't get yourself into a mess you don't want to be in just because you're trying to force your will on somebody. Negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. Some things won't work out. Some things you can't control. You know, whether you go to the Serenity Prayer, that is, give me the wisdom to know the difference between the things I can change and the things I can't, or you go to Stephen Covey's, one of his 7 habits of highly effective people, talks about your circle of concern and your circle of influence. And our circle of concern is often larger than our circle of influence. You know, I may have a circle of concern not just about my family and my career and the work I do and the friends and people around me, but also I might have a concern about the environment or about making sure everybody can eat in the world, or I might have a concern about health or the state of the computer industry, whatever it is. But a lot of that's beyond my circle of influence. And so it's a mistake to put my energies towards something that's outside my circle of influence. It's fine to have the concern, but don't think you can address the concern and bite off more than you should. Stick within your circle of influence and be effective there. That's where you get the most mileage. And there are limits to military power and its uses. And the Republicans just haven't quite learned that yet. They will, and they will after this war.
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
There's a man who leads a life of anger, and every day he gets a little stranger. With every word he speaks, he yells, he whines, he shrieks. Odds are he won't understand tomorrow. Right wing talk show host, ignorant talk show host. They've given you a time slot and taken away your brain. There's a group who spend their time complaining. It's bad enough they think that's entertaining. But their lenses are so skewed that all you can conclude
They're desperate for some IQ they can borrow. A rigid talk show host, batty talk show host. We're giving you a platform. It's time you were diagnosed. Simple thoughts, they come from simple minds. So notice who they blame and examine all their claims. Odds are you'll see through all their illogic. Right-wing talk show host, pompous talk show host. We've given you a forum, but you're still as deaf as a post.